Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is a conversation originally recorded in 1994 about the teaching of sexual legal issues in law schools around the United States. Richard Posner, former Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals, Larry Lessig, former Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Chicago, and Tom Smith, former Director General of the Social Survey at the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago, consider the long-term implications of the subject. We hope you enjoy today's episode and stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Larry, I'm interested in what you think is the future of teaching and research about sexuality in law schools. It's going to be a field that is tacitly consigned to people who have a strong sort of advocacy interest in it. I've noticed that most of the reviews of my book have been by feminists or male homosexuals, and I wonder whether it means this is a field that straight males or non-feminist women will avoid because they feel it's reserved for these sort of special pleaders.
Well, I'm not sure these are special pleaders. I mean, one of the challenges of your book is to bring into focus much of the data that underlies our presuppositions or prejudices about this unspoken of area. And these, I would imagine, feminists and homosexual advocates are people who have spent a lot of time trying to understand the data. So in economic terms, we could say they have a comparative advantage in speaking of this over standard constitutional law professors who spend their time not thinking about data as much as Supreme Court opinions. So it wouldn't necessarily be advocacy that's driving them, just that these would be people who are in a better position to respond to your challenge, and your challenge is one which attempts to bring data into this discourse where before it was prejudice.
I think the problem in this regard is when people approach a subject such as your book or any other subject from the point of view that I'm a feminist, I'm a spokesperson for this group, I'm a spokesperson for some other group, when obviously it should be approached in a more open intellectual manual and not in a kind of a group consciousness or an ideological position. Because then you just get a kind of repetition of standard lines rather than kind of a fresh intellectual look at things.
Well, it's unclear, though. Your book itself starts from a very distinctive perspective, a Millian framework of analysis, which attempts to ask the libertarian question, how much regulation of sex should the government engage in? Now, that's certainly one distinctive perspective. I mean, it's interesting in the book where that perspective lapses. At times, one could say that you've forgotten the libertarian origins and fallen back on more traditional or maybe more conservative premises. But this is certainly not a book that gives up the perspective, single perspective, midway or by the end. It seems focused on asking this question from a libertarian perspective, which is just one. It's certainly not a natural one.
Well, I think libertarianism describes the normative orientation of the book, but much of it is concerned, and I would think the most important part, with positive analysis, which I should think would have an interest beyond the ideological. Apart from feminist and homosexual rights reviews of my book, there have been several conservative reviews, people like Roger Scruton or Midge Dector, and they also have a very ideological and hostile cast, as if it's a subject for warring ideologies rather than for scientific investigation. And law schools are so ideological that you wonder whether there is room for dispassionate examination of these issues.
Well, there's a faith that you have in the, or maybe you don't have the faith, but a faith that the book presumes that that law could handle this data in a useful way. An interesting example of this right now is the debate going on in Colorado over Amendment 2, where a district court judge has been required to review a vast array of data of the historical and social science data regarding homosexuality to determine whether there's a compelling interest to discriminate in the allocation of civil rights laws for homosexuals. And the commentary that comes out of that, the descriptions of that trial, is that this is something way beyond the capacity of lawyers to deal with. That to the extent that this engages law directly, it's hard really to imagine the legal discourse incorporating this material in a way that will not have this tinge of ideology. Do you have more faith than the evidence so far suggests?
The problem is that the judges have great difficulty dealing with this subject matter, partly because of its emotionality, but partly because the law schools and the universities generally have not prepared the ground. They haven't equipped these people. I wonder whether a problem is sort of pervasive skepticism about data. Do you find the reaction to your survey work is simply disbelief in many quarters?
Well, then, when you turn to data and sex, the first thing you have to realize is how little there is out there, given the kind of immense importance of sexual behavior for the human species. There is probably less firm, reliable scientific data of the generalizable nature than on any other topic. You take, for example, unemployment. It's studied by each month a 50,000 case federal survey. Well, in the entire history of social science research, there hasn't been that much research done on sexual behavior. So the first is there's a lot of bad information, a lot of pop sociologists and magazine surveys and theory of the month in terms of what is really happening in terms of sexual behavior. The second thing is that sexual behavior, when you do get down to trying to study it in a social science perspective, a random, representative, high-quality surveys, is that this is a sensitive topic. This is not the topic that people are most at ease at talking about, and they do sometimes shade and distort their answers. You have to go to great length to try and encourage the frankness of reports. You then take this question that the data has to take and be viewed with a good deal of healthy scientific skepticism, and combine that with the idea that there are many groups with very strong ideological positions as to either what the truth is or what the truth should be. And they are completely unwilling to accept even the most persuasive data, much less data, which does have to be viewed with some skepticism.
Well, there have been efforts to validate these data. I know there have been efforts, for example, by questioning men and women separately and then pooling the results, seeing whether there are whether they don't match up. Are you satisfied with this literature?
Well, I think in some areas, for example, we now have enough repeated studies, different countries, and using different techniques, that some of the facts we're beginning to get a good firm handle on. For example, it's very clear that the traditional number, that 10% of the population is homosexual, is clearly an exaggerated number. There's been now over a half dozen studies from both the United States and from four European countries, which all show the number is in the low single digits rather than in terms of 10%, and that it's higher for males than it is for females. So in that area, for example, I think we have a growing scientific consensus on at least that one parameter. In other areas, for example, what the true level of extramarital relationships are, and certain other aspects, we have information that is much more tentative and much less certain at this point.
Larry, do you think the feminist and gay law movement will accept that the 10% figure is exaggerated?
Well, I'm not. I have no idea whether they would accept that it's exaggerated. I'm sure that they will yield to the consensus of scientific discussions, so long as the data questions are resolved. But that really leads to a separate question about the use that you make of the data in your book. Much of the analysis which you make of these questions, in the end, comes down to what you term an empirical question. You've identified forces on both sides of what we could think of as an economic problem, given us a model for thinking about how these forces pull in both directions. And then in the end, turn us to the data to resolve this dispute. Now, one question which the general unreliability of the data might raise is whether this could ever be a useful way of approaching these types of questions. More particularly, whether the data could ever be satisfactory enough to give us a compelling answer one way or the other in these types of questions. In particular, when you chastise, and rightfully so, the Supreme Court for its complete ignorance about the data. One wonders in interpreting constitutional provisions in particular, even if the data, even if they had full understanding of the best of the data that there is today, one wonders whether the court could do anything better, whether the data supports a stronger conclusion one way or the other.
I don't know exactly where the courts would be led if they had a fuller understanding of this problem. It might be they would end up in the same place because there are all sorts of political and institutional limitations on what they can do. So certainly the tone and content of the way they write about these questions would be different.
What would be better about the tone? I mean, take Bowers, for example.
Yeah, the homosexual sodomy case. The majority and concurring opinions give the impression of a sort of a contemptuous. Also, a sense of that they believe that people who advocate homosexual rights have a kind of effrontery to them. It's echoed in Bob Bork's book, The Tempting of America, where he compares the notion of giving rights to homosexuals to giving kleptomaniacs rights. Mm-hmm. Now, that clearly is a vast oversimplification of the phenomenon. On the other hand, the dissenting opinions in Bowers versus Hardwick treat homosexual orientation as the equivalent of preferring vanilla to raspberry ice cream. They regard it as an entirely unexceptionable variation in tastes. So that the long history of discrimination and fear and anxiety and toward this phenomenon is considered just grotesque ignorance. I don't think that's true.
Well, what would you add to that? I mean, you in your book in particular use the example of thinking of this as a problem of preference for vanilla versus chocolate ice cream as well. Now that's obviously partial description. What would you add to the dissent's description of what homosexuality is that would help it be a more useful opinion?
Some understanding of the fact that it is not easy to assimilate homosexuals into the marital culture of a modern Northern European North American society. One of the things I emphasize in the book is that in a culture of non-companionate marriage, loose emotional links between husband and wife, it's quite easy for, let's talk about men even with strong homosexual preference to function sort of unexceptionably in the social status of society. They're not expected to form intimate emotional ties with their wives. So the fact that they don't find the wives sexually attractive is really not essential. It's striking. There are a lot of reports that people in the Mediterranean cultures, where the non-companionate style of marriage is traditional, will often deny that there are any homosexuals in their society. I mean, they know better, but what they mean is that because the homosexuals blend in sort of comfortably with this non-companionate marriage system, means that they're just not socially interesting, like left-handed people. But in our society, where you know you're expected that your wife will be your best friend and so on, it's difficult for male homosexuals to have satisfying marriages. Now, even in this era of the disintegrating marriage, it is difficult for people who have you know opt out of that institution to fit in comfortably. I mean, look how disturbed parents are generally if they find out that their children are homosexual, because they feel that's excluding them from this essential institution. You know, even though not all people marry, not all heterosexuals marry, not all who do marry have children, not all have children that, looking back, they'd like to have had. But nevertheless, so I think there is a problem. There, it's not entirely, you know, vicious and inexplicable that homosexuals occupy such a sort of controversial niche in a society like ours. And recognition of that is entirely missing in the dissent. That's why also some people find incomprehensible the military attitude on homosexuality. I may be wrong and exaggerated and so on, but when you think of how, you know, the overall sexual marital structure of society, it's not entirely surprising that there should be these serious tensions. So that seems to me to be some awareness of that seems to me to be missing in the public and judicial engagement in the subject.
But had that awareness been in the dissent, I take it you ultimately would have dissented from the decision in Bowers. At least in your book, you state the sodomy laws should be repealed, at least.
I think those laws are ridiculous and should be repealed. I don't know about that. Whether the Supreme Court should be the agent of repeal, that's a much more difficult question. Even if you thought the laws were grotesque and functionless, it's a difficult question what to do about them. In fact, one of the things I find most disturbing about Bowers versus Hardwick is that there was a very serious question whether the case met the usual criteria for having a federal lawsuit, namely that there really was a controversy. It's true that Hardwick had been arrested for violating the Georgia sodomy law, but he was not prosecuted, and nobody had been prosecuted in Georgia for violation of the sodomy law for the last 40 years. So whether the law, maybe Hardwick or somebody could have explained some, could have set forth some hypothesis as to how this unenforced law actually has consequences, as it may, for all I know. But that wasn't done, and a cautious Supreme Court, I think, would have ducked the case and say we want a case where we really are convinced that this law is hurting people.
Well, your own description of the case, though, shows that Hardwick actually was presenting what was a real concern. His concern was not primarily the concern that the case ultimately revealed. His concern was that he was being harassed by local police merely because he was a homosexual. The local police would drive around the bar which he frequented. They harassed people coming out of the bar. This bar was a known gay bar. The basis of his arrest was the fact that he was seen coming out of the bar with an open container. There's some evidence of discriminatory enforcement of that law against homosexual bars as opposed to any other type of bar. They followed him back to his home in order to enforce an arrest warrant, as you said, and then came into his home to find him making love in his house. Hardwick's concern was a general attitude of the Georgia police to harass these people merely because they were homosexual. Not the more abstract question, which is how the court ultimately decided about the status of these laws. But the fact that you say that you don't know how ultimately you would come out in the constitutional question, I think raises again what the relevance of all of this should be for the constitutional question. How could it have really helped the social scientific data, as opposed to the data that I just described about the facts? How could it really have helped a court come out with a better answer?
Well, let me, before I answer that, let me just say a word about the facts of Hardwick. Two points. First, I think you're basing your facts in large part on the interviews that Hardwick gave after the case was decided, and various newspaper and magazine articles written about the case. Because there's a lot of this background as to the harassment and so on is not actually in the case itself. It's in the, I don't mean it's inaccurate, but it wasn't really before the Supreme Court. The other point is the relationship between police harassment of homosexuals and sodomy law is very complicated. France abolished its sodomy law during the French Revolution. It was never reinstated. But there's a long history of French police harassment of homosexuals. And I think the reason is that in any society in which homosexuals are subject to blackmail, one of the potential blackmail authorities will be the police. Again, if the Georgia police are harassing homosexuals, there is still a question what relation that harassment has to the law, whether enjoining the enforcement of the law would be effective means. On your larger and more fundamental question, what is the payoff for law of this kind of social science data? Possibly not large, because if you think of two great areas in which there is homosexual rights litigation, one are the sodomy laws and the other is the military discrimination. In the military discrimination, there's this strong judicial tradition of sort of hands off, and that may dominate and swamp all the data that could be obtained about how homosexuals actually perform in armed forces the world over and historically. And in the sodomy case, there is the difficulty of finding a constitutional handle for dealing with any form of sexual regulation, since it seems so remote from the text and the intentions of the constitutional framers. We know the Constitution is plastic. If judges who are immersed in these data obtained a very strong sense that these were pernicious and highly damaging laws, they would do something. It's possible, of course, the laws aren't that important, but that's whatever problems occupational integration or public status or harassment that homosexuals encounter in the United States may have absolutely nothing to do with legal regulations.
There's also an interesting angle in which you can look at the attitudes and how the attitudes in the law interact. You talked about how the constitutional issue might come in, and one is through this idea of a privacy right, an unspoken right in the Constitution, or one that's referred to by some specific things, but not as a general right, I perhaps should say. But there's a question that's been asked about, do you think homosexual relations between consenting adults should be legal? And you get a certain level of support when you ask in that way. And then you ask the question, do you think homosexual relations between consenting adults in the privacy of their own homes should be asked? And you get 20 percentage points higher support, mm-hmm. which shows how important the issue of privacy can be mm-hmm. when it augments the initial issue of homosexual relations.
That's very interesting, because it suggests that some of us purists have long criticized the Supreme Court for having appropriated the term privacy to describe what really is a form of autonomy or freedom. Because, you know, you don't think of abortion. Abortion is not the same sort of an abortion right is not the same sort of privacy right as even a right, you know, not to be harassed by telephone solicitors, or a right not to have your arrest record publicized. So concealment and seclusion are sort of at the core of the ordinary language use of the word privacy. And the right to buy contraceptives, the right to engage in homosexual activity, the right to have an abortion are a different sense. But, you know, your point shows that the Supreme Court had, you know, they have a political or they have a political sensitivity or knack in appropriating this word, which has such a highly charged, such a favorable valence for use in connection with sex.
It's also interesting how that connects to the role of the court. It's hopeful, perhaps, and as our colleague Jerry Rosenberg would say, it's a hollow hope, to say that the court's discussion of these types of questions will actually have any type of effect on people's actual attitudes about this. I mean, let's say in Bowers the Supreme Court had followed the dissent and said that this was, in essence, a fundamental right of autonomy to choose how to act upon preferences that you have in this realm. This was something done in the privacy of Hardwick's own home, and that it, to echo the words of Douglas, it really would have been extraordinary to imagine the police coming into people's homes to find the telltale signs of acts of sodomy. So if that had been the rhetoric that the court had used, one could ask, and law professors at least would hope, whether people's attitudes in the whole discourse about how one discusses homosexuality would change. This would no longer be a special type of sickness or a special type of deviance that law properly could attempt to regulate. This would be just one manifestation of human identity. If anything, there's a role for the court in attempting to reconstruct something of social attitudes. You think the Constitution is plastic, but people are not. One might wonder whether the way the court speaks about these issues, the way it frames it, changes the way people think about it. I mean, if public opinion survey research can change the way people think about it merely by saying this is a privacy question, one might wonder whether the Supreme Court, too, if it thought about it like this, could have an actual effect on how people approach it.
Well, let me say two things regard to that. One, I think what we learned from the public opinion research on this is not that it's changed by kind of an artificial introduction of this phrase, but that privacy is such an important issue that when you bring it to the tops of their minds, it has a quite understandable strong impact on it. I think there's also a lot of good historical evidence. It's sometimes contested, but I think there's very good evidence that a Supreme Court that takes a strong and either unanimous or a very strong majority decision can have quite some impact. There's certainly a lot of speculation, for example, with the recent sexual harassment case, that the unanimous decision, the very quick turnaround, will send, first of all, a very clear message to the lower courts as to how the Supreme Courts want them to act, but beyond the judicial system, will send a message to employers about the proper parameters of behavior in the workplace. And I think that speculation is probably correct, that this, along with a series of other governmental and judicial decisions, will help to take and both sensitize and ultimately change attitudes and behaviors in this case in regard to sexual harassment, but also, of course, in terms of potentially other areas of sexual behavior, in terms of For example, there is a very good series from our own organization that shows that when the Supreme Court made the Roe versus Wade decision, that this moved public opinion about 10 percentage points into an accepting of abortion decision. Hmm. It had now been legitimized by the Supreme Court. It did not change, you know, all minds, as we see now, you know, 20 years later, that they're still very divisive. But there was a discernible difference. And we can even show that this difference was occurred exclusively among those who had heard about the Supreme Court decision. So we can kind of narrow it down, saying it wasn't just general social change, it wasn't just a general liberalizing, but that the increased approval were among those who were aware of the decision in 73.
Well, that suggests maybe a reversal of the method that Dick, you were suggesting. I mean, if we focus first on the court as articulating principle, which you would scorn because it sounds like it's removed from the data, but thinking first about principle and then looking to the data to see whether the data contradicts this in any firm way, that seems to accord more fully with the actual court practice in how they should think, or at least how con law professors would say they should think about these questions. I mean, we could take the marriage example, which I think is a striking example in your own book of how not focusing first on the principle or thinking primarily about the principle or losing sight of that can lead one down a more traditional conservative path. You raise the question of whether homosexual marriage should be approved or should be permitted. And you start by saying that we libertarians will ask first whether there's a good third-party reason for prohibiting it. And then instantly you move into three reasons why it should not be ultimately permitted, although you don't reach a final conclusion in the book. And the first reason has not to do with a libertarian concern. The reason is that the state should not give sanction or give its endorsement to a way of life which you characterize as inferior. And the second has to do with the informational costs of homosexual marriage, and the third with the question of whether we want to spend money or we want to accord these benefits. Now, just think about the first for a second. You say in the book that the state should not give its endorsement to this way of life. Even from an economic perspective, it's an odd conclusion. I mean, one might say that it's an unfortunate state of life to grow up in a ghetto in America. And one might also say it's an unfortunate state of life to have to work in McDonald's. But it would not follow that for one living in a ghetto, the choice to work in McDonald's is a bad choice. So even if you think that homosexual lifestyle, which I would say is a contentious and I wouldn't agree, but a homosexual lifestyle is an inferior lifestyle, the proper economic question, it would seem, would be on the margin whether this would be an improvement to the situation that homosexuals face if the state were to permit this type of relationship, marriage relationship. And even if, on average, this is less beneficial or less beneficial form of lifestyle, given all that you've said about the fact that this is not ultimately just a simple choice, it would seem that you would be directed to ask whether it wouldn't be better for homosexuals to be in a position to choose this as one type of life. And if they, as a libertarian would say, voluntarily choose it as a way of life, why wouldn't that be all that a libertarian would need to know this was perfectly acceptable?
Well, I don't like your term inferior lifestyle. I don't think I used that term. What I said was I don't think, even in a tolerant society, that the homosexual lifestyle, if you want to call it that, the homosexual life is going to be, on average, as happy a one as a heterosexual. I think there are barriers that are, you know, that are not connected with intolerance, but have to do with the nature of men. And men pairing off with other men rather than women, that creates problems. But inferior makes it sound as if I'm making a moral judgment or
kind of
a caste system where you have inferiors.
But from a utilitarian standpoint, less happy would just be an inferior lifestyle. But I'm happy to, I mean, that's perfectly fine to say.
Yeah, inferior has overtones.
That's fine. So if we say not inferior.
My only concern was that Permitting the marriage might put the government in the position of propagating a kind of a false view of the equality of potential happiness of homosexual and heterosexual union. Because I would expect homosexual marriages to be even more unstable than homosexual among men to be even more unstable than the heterosexual. That's one point. The other point is, the libertarian position on marriage has to be a complicated one, because after all, marriage is a status which the state allows you to enter. It's not a private contract. You could say that from the libertarian standpoint, the whole institution of marriage is somewhat anomalous, and that it should be looked at as a form contract that people ought to be permitted to vary as they want. It is a puzzle that we have that, you know, we don't allow, for example, 5-year marriages. We'd allow that with other employment type contracts. Why not for this?
Right, but taking just the libertarian perspective with respect to homosexual marriage, why is it a relevant concern for the libertarian perspective that this might, on average, be a less happy form of life? For a homosexual, whatever the level of his happiness is here, why wouldn't the libertarians say, obviously you should make the choice available to him to enter into a marriage?
But I think this is kind of sort of American sort of TV sentimentality. I mean, the Danes and the Swedes, for example, I think are more realistic people than Americans. I mean, they realize that marriage is tied up historically with heterosexual relationships with an expectation of children, not all the time. So what they have said is, I mean, the Danes do it the cleanest way. They say if you want to have a homosexual union, and every provision of the Danish marriage code will be applicable except those that pertain to children. So it seems perfectly straightforward. They call it domestic partnership because it isn't identical to marriage. It's part of the marriage code, the part that's relevant. I call it domestic partnership. That seems to me to be entirely sensible. We ought to have the same thing. But in America, I think the reason for wanting to have recognized homosexual marriage is not the concrete reasons, the spousal benefits and so on, they can all be done by contract or by some cohabitation form like the Swedish or the Danish. It's to bring all the sentimental overtones of marriage into this homosexual relationship and to say, in the manner of the dissenters in Bowers versus Hardwick, you know, this is America, everybody can be just as happy as everybody else. And there's no difference between a homosexual relationship and a heterosexual. But there is a difference, I think, maybe wrong, but I think there are deep biological reasons why male-male relationships will always be different from male-female, and that we should recognize that, not pretend otherwise. I'm interested in this question, whether Supreme Court decisions do influence public opinion. I've been reading Reeves's book about the Kennedy presidency, an outstanding book, it seems to me. What's striking about that is that there's a lot, of course, about civil rights and how it blew up in the early 60s. Nobody ever refers to Brown versus Board of Education as a factor in the civil rights revolution. When the Kennedys came into power, they had no interest in civil rights. And when the blacks began demonstrating in the South, in Birmingham and so on, they were just very exasperated at this business, which was distracting them from their real interest, which was foreign affairs. And when they tried to figure out why the blacks were becoming so difficult, there's a striking conversation between John Kennedy a black, one of his relatively few black friends, in which he asked this fellow, you know, why are these people so militant all of a sudden? And the fellow said, it's you, Mr. President. You have lifted their aspirations. And something about the Kennedy spirit, the changing of the guard, the passing of Eisenhower, had helped to encourage this militancy, along with a lot of other things having to do with the situation of blacks, but not Brown versus Board of Education. That doesn't seem to be in the background of the early 60s lunch counter, desegregation, marches, and then the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and what we really regard as key. I think Bowers and Hardwick decided the other way, would simply have diminished the Supreme Court's authority. In the same way that the Supreme Court's, the Warren, in the era of Warren, creating all sorts of new rights for criminal defendants, simply diminished the Supreme Court's authority. I mean, Americans don't like criminals. They don't want them to have rights. When the Supreme Court abolished capital punishment in the Furman case, did people all of a sudden wake up and say, my God, capital punishment is savage? We understand now from the Supreme Court this is a barbarous institution. It's been abolished in all of Europe. No. So capital punishment was reimposed, and today, as in, you know better than I do, I think it has the support of 75% of the population, enthusiastic support. So it may be that with Roe versus Wade, some other cases have had a legitimating effect on social practices, but I think where there are strong emotional, because after all, there are a lot of people on the fence on abortion, but I think where there are very strong emotional feelings, as there are in this country about homosexuality, as your polls show year in and year out, I think I think it's a good thing about Americans. They tend not to take their cues from officials. And the Supreme Court justices, other judges, are just another bunch of officials. You know, de haute en bas. The educated, the civilized, telling hoi polloi how they ought to think. I don't think they...
So this means that if Bowers had been decided 6 years after it was decided, and it had the benefit of Sex and Reason as a book, and it had come out the other way, and it had said, see this wonderful book that shows the complete irrationality of this as a form of regulation, and it's a sort of irrationality that we will no longer tolerate, consistent with our longstanding respect, and in some ways, you suggest exaggerated respect for sexual autonomy, and therefore these statutes would be struck down. You think that would have just had the response of weakening the institution, which I guess might raise the question. Might raise the question how useful this type of analysis will be ultimately to the legal culture and the legal political culture.
Well, Bowers versus Hardwick would have been a significant decision for us lawyers anyway, if it had gone the other way, even if it didn't affect American thinking about homosexuality. One reason it could not have gone the other way, I think, was AIDS, which is not mentioned in any of the opinions. And I think before the Supreme Court could take on an issue of this sort in a serious way, it would have to be able to think about the relationship between the sodomy laws and AIDS. And probably there's none. And the sodomy laws are not a way of fighting AIDS. But they, I think, have to be able to think through this situation and satisfy themselves on that before they can decide such a case. But I would think that sexual regulation, the economics and social science and data about sex, would be important in law school, even if it did not result in fundamental changes in legal doctrine, or even if it did so over a very long period of time. To take a concrete example, the model penal code drafted by the American Law Institute in the early 50s did abolish the crime of sodomy, and was adopted in Illinois, and, or that portion of it was adopted by Illinois in the 60s. and is an example of how scholarly thinking on these subjects of sexuality can influence the law. And I should think that even if the Supreme Court, in its vulnerable position and limited authority, were unwilling to take on the sodomy question, you can imagine law professors working with data and with theory, persuading these state legislatures to change their...
Well, it is striking, and I'm sure the data supports this, it is striking that the effect of your book, well, the use of the data in your book is primarily to debunk these prejudices which most people, and whether conservative or liberal, I think, most people would begin to approach the subject with. So it's certainly true that to the extent the data has some effect, it has an effect in taking care of the prejudices. But the question of whether it can do something more in guiding legal discourse once we've eliminated the prejudices, at least in constitutional law, is one that I think turns on the capacity of constitutional law to remove itself from its text, structure, and historical focus and become more pragmatic. But the question of whether law can become more pragmatic is maybe one we need to take up at a different time.